This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm. We all know we're going to die, but surprisingly, more than half of American adults don't have a will or any other estate plan in place. And while mom or dad may leave you a house full of memories when they die, do you know where to find their life insurance papers, their military discharge documents, or their safety deposit key? Today on Vermont Edition, we thought we'd go over some of the things you should be thinking about concerning end of life so that your loved ones aren't left in the lurch. We'll go over what you need to know about planning funerals and what services the visiting nurses and hospice care can provide. But we'll start with the legal side of things, and here to help us with that is Daphne Moritz, partner at Melendi Moritz Law Firm. Daphne Moritz, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Nina, for having me on the show.
Yeah, I was surprised to find that so few adult Americans have a will, and nearly two-thirds of women between the ages of 45 and 54 don't have a will. So what happens when you die without a will? What's the big deal there?
Well, it is important to think about your planning like this. If you die without a will, there is a process which is follows a statute of intestacy. And if you die with a spouse, then your spouse, you know, it's just a process, but it kind of extends the process. It might be a more messy process for your loved ones. So even though statutes account for that, it's not the neatest way to leave things. And a lot of people that we see, of course, want to not be too burdensome to their children and other loved ones. So I think in the spirit of that alone, planning, and not just estate planning, but thinking through quality of life and what I consider planning to live well and planning to die well are really important topics to discuss.
Sure. We've all heard stories where families have been really torn up emotionally and sometimes end up getting on the outs with each other because there was no will. You mentioned that, you know, the estate process or the probate process that occurs. If someone doesn't have a will, how much longer does it take to sort through their belongings and finances? Is it quite a bit longer or just more complicated?
Well, probably both. And I can't really give a specific timeline, but certainly you touched on where everything is, where all your assets are. So that's a bigger issue if you've never told anybody about what you own and how you own it. The person in the process of dying intestate, somebody needs to step up, or somebody will step up eventually and be named, appointed as administrator by the court. That is if somebody files a petition to do so. And then the kind of the process is similar to dying with a will in terms of getting an inventory of the estate together. But of course, if your stuff is all over the place and nobody really knows where to find it, it is well more complicated.
Michael emailed in this comment, "I'm interested in the options for someone who wants to handle their planning, particularly wills, by themselves, i.e. without a lawyer. I'm pretty sure most of the things my wife and I have planned are pretty straightforward, but I'd like to hear a knowledgeable discussion about the options and constraints of proceeding in this fashion, particularly in Vermont." Daphne Moritz, what do you tell people who want to do this on their own? Are there places online they can look to get a boilerplate will?
Well, most people who come to see me aren't asking to do this on their own, of course, but it is a great question because I think what I would go back to is everybody's situation is so unique to themselves. Of course, I think that going with an attorney is important because of our wealth of knowledge and our ability to look at our history with clients and guide them through the morass. However, there are places now, I think that support public radio that where you can actually find DIY documents. That said, I think that it's important to kind of dig deeper than what an online form might do for you. So probably having something is better than nothing. On the other hand, we do find ourselves at times involved with undoing DIY work or being in the throes of something messy that was done sometimes with an attorney, but sometimes without an attorney that just, you know, didn't quite comport to what needed to really happen. So it can get a little sloppy, too.
Well, it made me think doing this program today made me realize it's been a long time since I've updated my will. And I'm wondering how many people out there think, well, I've done my will and it may be 20 or 30 years old. Things have changed. Maybe they were in a different state when they made the will. How often should people be updating these documents?
It's funny. When I talk to organizations, I always say things like relevance, relevance, relevance somewhere in my talk, because it is so important to keep your plan up to date. A lot of families will come in when they have young children. This is a note to families or grandparents out there with grandkids to tell their children to think about naming a guardian. So people will come in and do a will and name the guardian, and that's for minor children. And that is very important. If you've done nothing else, you know, that is extremely important. But then they'll wait, like you said, 20 years before they come in again. And since then, they themselves might have grandchildren. They might have bought two or three homes in that process. They've amassed some wealth, or they've lost some wealth, or they have children that now have, or a loved one with special needs. So there are a lot of life instances that happen between the time you start the process and the time of your death. So keeping it relevant and up to date is important. It's not just wills. Documents from out of state can be fine if they were executed properly. It's not that there isn't acceptance and acknowledgement in other states. But there are differences in some of the states, but mostly it's your life changes, not just that you've moved, but lots of things in your life change over the course of 20 or 30 or 40 years.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about end-of-life issues today on Vermont Edition. My guest is Daphne Moritz. She's a partner at Melendi Moritz Law Firm. We're covering some of the legal aspects. If you would like to join our conversation, maybe you've got a question or been wondering about some of these topics, what documents to have on hand, how to better organize the documents that you do have, you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211, or post your comments or questions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Well, we've covered the will. What other legal documents are important for people to have when they're considering end-of-life issues? You know, what are the top three or four documents that people really, besides the will, should have on hand?
I personally think your most important document is the document you need during your lifetime and is irrelevant after your death, which is your advance directives. Some people refer to them as healthcare powers of attorney. They used to be called, you know, healthcare powers and living wills, but Vermont put them together in an advance directive for healthcare. And also your financial powers of attorney. Those two documents, along with just making sure that you have a HIPAA, the health, you know, we have a Privacy Act and something that allows you to let some people in your life see your medical records. Those documents are very important during your life. The reason why is, and not enough people probably have these documents, let alone a will. The reason why you would like to, encourage people to have advance directives is because if you become incapacitated and you're unable to talk to your healthcare professional about your wishes, should you not be able to improve from a crisis, a medical crisis, you actually are offering your agent guidance, your own guidance. This is what I would want if, and giving them that direction. This takes a little pressure, I think, off of people in your life that you would name as your agent or you would want to do those things. It also usually helps stave off a guardianship proceeding, which we could talk about later. But I guardianship for an adult, and I'm talking about involuntary guardianship, which is a court process. So
that's when you feel someone in your family, say an elderly relative, can't take care of themselves anymore. Is that what you're saying?
And you step in. Yes, and somebody needs to come in and take care of that financially, and maybe also for the healthcare of the person. With powers of attorney, financial, and the advance directive, you hopefully have somebody already in charge of that that you've named. And it also provides you as the individual, the principal, control in some to some degree that you know that these things that you've these wishes that you've wanted will be met or should be met. That's not to say they're perfect documents and that they work 100% every time. But I have to say, I think there is much a better likelihood that things will be done your way than if you leave it to both your loved ones without any guidance and without any discussion, and certainly the medical professionals who have a duty to, you know, keep you alive at any cost if you don't have any directive. So doing nothing is also making a choice. It's just not necessarily making the choice that you ultimately
the person would want.
Right.
Yes. Well, you know, I think a lot of people say that it's just hard to bring this issue up. When is a good mm-hmm. time to sit down and say, so what are your thoughts on, you know, if you're in a car accident or hit by a bus? And I guess I wanted to share a story because for my family, it actually helped quite a bit. For many years, my family and my husband's family took a family reunion trip a week up in northern Wisconsin, where we're both from. And my husband is a physician, and about 6 or 7 years ago, as we were all sitting around the lake, he took each family aside at some point, his family, parents and siblings, and sat down, my parents and siblings, and sat down and sort of wrote down advance directive wishes. And I remember thinking it was a little morbid, but kind of awkward, but we were all in a good mood. We were relaxed, and it actually worked great. And what was sort of bittersweet about it is just a few years later, my dad had a stroke, and all of us were on the same page, my brother from California, me from Vermont, and we were all able to know, well, this is what my dad wanted. We remember him talking about that. And I think it did make it a lot easier, but I think a lot of people find it very difficult to know a good time to bring the topic up. And I'm wondering, do you have any advice? Have you found something that's helpful for families to start the dialogue?
You know, it is really unique to all families. And I love your story. That was perfect. If you can find a time where you are gathered together with your siblings and it's a relaxed time, it's not full of, you know, maybe those Thanksgivings that are on Saturday Night Live are not the right time to do it. But maybe there's another time to kind of be calm and just start talking about, you know, mom, dad, have you thought about so many things? I mean, the opening could be a neighbor, a friend, another relative that has had some issues, because a lot of my clients have brought up, oh, yes, I remember when my mother-in-law had this, or my neighbor had this other circumstance, and I don't want that to happen to me. So if you have an opening of an anecdote that didn't go so well, maybe that's a way to kind of start picking your parents' brains or, you know, your spouse's or whomever, and get that discussion flowing, because there are a lot of things to think about, including, you know, aging in place or in another residence or downsizing.
Susan posted this comment: a great way to start normalizing discussions around end of life would be to stop reiterating the cultural taboo with introductions like mine today, that it's not something most people want to think about nor plan for. Why not start with, there are many decisions to make regarding what will happen when you die? And she says, public radio is a great forum to have honest conversations about death. And Silas posted this: there should be a life course that is mandatory in high school with a manual that the students can use throughout their lifetime. The teacher this stuff, kind of the complete cradle-to-grave manual of life's quote-unquote needs to know in lessons and story format. That's a great idea. Listeners, you can jump into the conversation today by calling 1-800-639-2211. What questions do you have concerning end-of-life issues? Maybe you're thinking about planning your own funeral, or you've got some legal questions. Again, 1-800-639-2211. I'd like to bring another perspective now to the program. Lee Webster is president of the National Home Funeral Alliance. She's on the phone with us now. Lee Webster, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Nina. I'm happy to be here.
So some people may be proactive about making their funeral arrangements, but again, that's another subject that can be kind of hard to get your head around. So when people come to a funeral director and say, I want to get my quote-unquote affairs in order, what are the first steps to do that?
It's interesting that you ask the question that way, because the first first thing that people need to decide is whether they want to hire a funeral director at all. I think to back up the question a little bit, we might want to ask who's going to be in charge when I die and who's going to be responsible for making whatever arrangements, you know, I've told you about come true. One of the options is to hire a funeral director, and at that point you're going to want to tell them what route you want to go, the very contemporary route, and you have to be prepared then to spend about $10,000, and you want to know what it is that you're purchasing. Is it a viewing? Is it a funeral service? All those types of things. The other choice is to have after-death care in the home at virtually no cost, and that's a second option that most people don't know they have. A third is to blend the two.
So, what was the second option, after-death care in the home?
In the
Explain
home.
That.
Sure. Well, that's when the family, who, by the way, has legal custody and control of the body at the moment of death, the DPOAH, your health care durable power, does not have control over this anymore. It's next of kin, or a person that the decedent has designated as their agent for specifically prior to their death. They basically are going to just ensure that that person continues to be cared for, has appropriate body care, mm-hmm, in the home, everything's taken care of within the family. And it's a question of where the body rests for a couple of days. In Vermont, it's 24 hours prior to, from the time of death to cremation. So the body has to be somewhere. The body has to rest somewhere. The question is, will that person rest at home with the family around them, or will they go to a funeral home to stay for that period of time waiting for the final disposition?
Let me ask you a more nuts and bolts question about, mm-hmm, so a person has decided to contact a funeral director. They,
yeah,
do want a traditional funeral or maybe a cremation, whatever. What sorts of things does the funeral director then sit down and go over? You know, does the funeral director help that person kind of figure out documents, or, you know, who sits down and says, you need these many death certificate notices and, you know, this is,
yeah,
where you do
the... Yeah, the only thing that a funeral director has to do with paperwork is to file the death certificate for you if you hire them to do that. And essentially all the information that's on the demographic part of the death certificate comes from the family. So they're going to be asking you for, I think you mentioned earlier, military papers, the discharge papers, you know, mother's maiden name, and, you know, all kinds of different, you know, social security numbers, all those types of things. But those things are things that most of us kind of carry in our own heads. It's a good idea to have prepared for that, and we actually have a document that you can use as a worksheet so that you can fill out all that information and have it ready, which is less stressful than trying to do it at the moment that someone dies.
Oh, you're
but
in such
gonna
an...
be asking basic info.
So you're in such an emotional fog when you're dealing with the death of a loved one, but I was surprised going through it with family members, all of the documentation that you do need. And I think it can be a little overwhelming, you know, all the death certificates, who gets them, how many do you need? As you mentioned, the military papers.
Mm-hmm.
When does Social Security start and stop? What about bank accounts? How much do funeral directors help with that? And where else can, besides a funeral home, can people get help with those kinds of questions?
Well, I think that funeral directors don't have a lot to do with the business of your personal life being settled. Often your attorney will be very helpful with things. Some of the issues really gets handled more by the family. They're the ones who are making notifications to, you know, the hairdresser and the newspaper delivery and that type of thing. Government agencies like Veterans Affairs, Social Security, funeral directors will notify them and get that ball rolling for you, which is very helpful, or you can do it yourself. But the family still has to follow through with that. Other people, you know, tax accountants, investment brokers, insurance agents, all those people are very helpful, along with an attorney. Bankers, you know, you want to get your credit cards stopped, and you want to get all of your bank business taken care of. A really big piece of this now that we live this huge digital life is making sure that someone has your passwords and knows what all of your online accounts are, your social media accounts, media sharing accounts like photos and so on that you wouldn't want to have lost, direct access bank accounts, PayPal, automatic payments, that type of thing. So really, it's up to the family to manage those affairs.
Right.
A durable power of attorney for finance is going to help with that, but that's not a funeral director's job.
Well, I think I went to an interesting talk a month or two ago that addressed that very issue, that most of us should take a few hours and just make a roadmap, or they called it a love letter to their relatives, listing all the bank accounts, the passwords, where your insurance policies are, where you keep things, just to leave relatives something so that they're not scrambling. Lee Webster, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us and share your expertise.
Thank you.
Lee Webster is president of the National Home Funeral Alliance, and we're going to get to more of your calls on end-of-life issues after a short break. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck, in for Jane Lindholm. Death and how to plan for it may not be a topic we're terribly comfortable with, but a little bit of forethought can go a long way in making things easier for loved ones. Daphne Moritz is a partner at Melendi Moritz Law Firm. She's helping answer legal questions today, and we'll take your calls. If you have a question, you can join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211. And let's take a call now from Heartland. Regina is on the line. Hi, Regina. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. I don't necessarily have a question, but I had a comment in regards to the last guest. I agree having the passwords for social media and death certificates is really important. We had an adult child who died in an accident 4 years ago, and we did not have that information on hand because it was an accident situation, and that it's critical even for young adults to share that information with loved ones so that they do have that information in case you do need it, and you do need the death certificates to access those social media accounts and close them.
Sure. Regina, I'm sorry for the loss of your son. You brought up a really good point, and I think most of us, you know, when you think about Facebook and other social media accounts, yeah, you do need the passwords for those, too, because that's immediately where a lot of people will gravitate to. Let's go to Rutland now and take a call from Beth. Hi, Beth. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thank you. This is kind of, it's a juvenile phone call because I found out that, you know, when your parents die, you have these juvenile wishes, but I kind of have this grudge against the Catholic Church where my father had his funeral mass. I wanted a secular song played. It didn't necessarily have to be sung, but I wanted a secular song played, and they would not play it. It was not a religious hymn, and here I am 13 years later still nursing this grudge. But it's things like that give you comfort, and people should realize that if you want a certain song played or sung and it's going to give you comfort, I think the Catholic Church they kind of have to loosen up. I've been to other churches, you know, other religious, not Catholic churches.
That have been more flexible. Beth, I think I've got your point. I'm going to just step in because I think I've got your point, and I'm sure that issue comes up a lot depending on where you're having a particular service, having to fit in with the rules of whatever church or synagogue or wherever you're having a funeral. And that can be tricky, I think, when emotions are at play. I've heard similar points brought up by other people throughout the years, so I'm sure Beth's point is not a singular issue. I want to take a few other calls. Let's go to Walden now and talk with Joe. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Hello. I was wondering, in the case of advance directives for people who travel, or for us, we live in, we became snowbirds when we retired. And so it's occurred to me, where is the advance directive needed? Is it at every place you may be when you need it? Or is it your residence state? You know, would that apply if you needed it in another state?
Great question. Daphne Moritz.
I would say that if it's executed properly in one state, it's going to be fine in another state. Your state of residence really should be, you have to usually choose one state of residence, and that should be the place where you probably do your estate planning in total, including your health care power, your advance directive. I also think that on the line of advance directives, they should be with your agent, probably your primary care physician. So if you have one in each state, you know, two states, each of them should have your health care directive so that it's somewhere and can be located. Vermont also has an advance directive registry, which is actually located outside of the state, but it actually allows doctors in any setting to locate your advance directive. You get a card, you get some little stickers. So if you're carrying around your ID your wallet, it's a wallet card. I think the trouble occurs when people, like, you know, run and don't have any ID on them, but that's another story for another day. Advance directive should be acceptable in every state, even though states might have their own statutes guiding them.
I'd like to bring in another voice right now into the conversation. Christine Wernicke is Vice President of Business Development and Marketing for the Visiting Nurses Association of Chittenden and Grand Isle Counties. Christine Wernicke, I'm glad you could be on the show today. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So we've talked a lot today about some of the legal issues, funeral issues, things that people can do to make it easier for loved ones after you die. But I'd like to ask you about what the visiting nurses and hospice services can offer someone to make the actual process of dying better. So how do you broach that subject with potential clients?
Yeah, I think Daphne has done a great job talking about advance directives and the importance of that. And we in the past couple of years have really stressed the importance of conversations with your family. And that should begin early, very early, before you become sick, before you maybe get to the point of, an older age or becoming more frail or vulnerable. Of course, things can happen at any point in time, such as one of your callers expressed the accident situation, and that's unfortunate. But that's another reason why having these conversations with your family often and regularly, similar to your story about your family getaway and the vacation and sort of bringing that up, you don't know when something's going to happen. And so talking about it early and often is really the most important step.
I was surprised to learn that Vermont ranks 48th in the country for use of hospice. So for whatever reason, Vermonters are not as open to it. Why do you think that is?
It's really a great question. We have been looking at this for many years, and we've seen that Vermont's ranking as near the bottom in the country. And when you look at Vermont healthcare quality, we have even most recently, in the last ranking, was the second most healthiest state behind Hawaii. So when we see that we're ranked 48th in the country for hospice care, which is widely recognized as high quality care at end of life, we wanted to know why Vermonters are not using hospice. And so we're in the process now of a statewide study that's exploring that and trying to understand if Vermonters are not using hospice, why, and what experiences are they having with end of life care, because we don't necessarily see that there's an unusually high rate of deaths in the hospital. So we're trying to understand what is happening with Vermonters when they're dying. Are they dying at home, and what kind of support do they have available?
Elise in Burlington emailed in this comment, "It's essential to not assume anyone wants any responsibility for your end-of-life and post-death decisions. It's essential to have a conversation with the person or persons you are designating for all aspects of pre- and post-death planning." That's an interesting point. You may designate somebody, and they might be surprised at that. I hadn't really thought about that. Christine Wernicke, do you ever see that in a hospice situation where, you know, someone is surprised to be the designated person in charge?
We have heard of individuals maybe not being so much surprised that they're the designated person, but being unprepared to know what decisions they are supposed to make. And that's really where the advanced directive document is a good tool for having those conversations. But really nothing replaces the having a conversation with your loved one about what kind of care you want. But and really, it's not so much about making those specific care decisions. It's really about what do you want your life to look like? How do you want to live your final months, weeks, days? Where does that look? Where does that take place? What does it look like? What kinds of things are important to you? What do you want to accomplish or what do you want to see? Those are the kinds of things that you would talk about. And then your healthcare providers help you meet those goals. It's really about what are your goals, and then the healthcare providers, once they know what those are, they can navigate the healthcare choices and give you good informed advice.
Well, Christine Wernicke, thank you so much for being on the program today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Christine Wernicke is Vice President of Business Development and Marketing for the Visiting Nurses Association of Chittenden and Grand Isle Counties. And I think we have time for one more question. Daphne Moritz, I guess if you were to give one last piece of advice for someone, we have covered a lot of ground on different documents, but is part of it just knowing where your documents are? I mean, where should you keep your important documents?
Oh, my gosh. That's a...
I'll narrow it to that. Where to put all this stuff?
Well, I would put some information in writing about what you own and where it is. Investment assets sit in an investment account, bank accounts in a bank account, your IRA also kind of there in an investment portfolio somehow, and your car, your house. So you have a lot of different stuff, and really it's about documenting what you have and how it's held and then where it is. And then giving that along with digital asset information to someone who you probably name as executor or trustee or a whole nother person, but somebody you trust inherently to gather that information. Because remember, your power of attorney isn't good once you're dead. So it's really a trust or a will that will guide that process after your death. So gathering that, putting it in writing, giving it to somebody who knows where it is very important.
And who's ready to take the information. Well, Daphne Moritz, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking so much time. We covered a lot of ground and it was really helpful.
You're so welcome. I appreciate it.
Daphne Moritz is a partner at Melendi Moritz Law Firm. Still to come, we'll talk with the Episcopal Bishop Thomas Ely about the church's recent decision to allow same-sex couples to get married in the church. Stay with us on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Kack. When the Supreme Court ruled recently to affirm same-sex marriage in all states, many critics called it a blow to religious freedom and said the ruling would contradict faiths that disavow homosexuality. But many churches have been grappling for some time with the issue of same-sex marriage. Last week in Utah, the leadership of the Episcopal Church found a compromise, voting to allow priests the right to perform church weddings for same-sex couples, while at the same time allowing their clergy the right to refuse to perform such services. Here to talk about what went into that decision is Thomas Ely, Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Vermont. Bishop Ely, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Nina. It's good to be on the program.
So you were at the Episcopal Church's General Convention meeting in Salt Lake City, and you served on the church's task force on the study of marriage. How contentious or not contentious a vote was it?
Well, the vote was pretty overwhelming in support of the decisions that we reached, which were really three resolutions that were passed. One, to continue the work of the task force on the study of marriage. The second was to authorize trial use of liturgies for marriage for all couples. And the third was to a resolution expanding our canon in its understanding of marriage. So there were three actions that were taken.
So I thought many Episcopal churches in Vermont were already performing same-sex marriages.
Right. For Vermont, this doesn't mean a whole lot of change because in past general conventions, the Episcopal Church has made provision for the blessing of of covenanted same-sex relationships and given to a certain amount of pastoral capacity for bishops in dioceses where there is same-sex marriage civilly available, allow us to adapt those liturgies for use with same-sex couples. So we've been doing that here in Vermont for several years now. But for many other places around the Episcopal Church, according, you know, obviously with the Supreme Court's decision, the whole question of civil marriage equality was opened up broadly. And so this was timing was important for us. And so now this expands that understanding, what we've been practicing here in Vermont for a long time, to other dioceses.
You said it was an overwhelming vote in favor, but how were the concerns of the dissenters taken into account? I understand that any clergy can refuse to perform a same-sex marriage, but were there other concessions as well?
Well, just to be clear, our canons provide for any clergy person to decline to perform any marriage, whether it's same-sex or different-sex couple.
Okay.
So this was just extending the same opportunity that clergy have under any circumstances. But the concerns of those who were not supportive of this direction were taken into account by making sure that the trial liturgies fall under the direction of and with the permission of the diocesan bishop. So bishops have a lot of say in how they're used and if they're used. But there's also a pastoral provision that was put in that said if a bishop is not going to give permission for his clergy to use these rites, that bishop does need to make these rites accessible to the couples. And how bishops will do that remains to be seen. Some of the suggestions were that could ask another bishop in a neighboring diocese to make provision. But the pastoral piece was to make sure that all couples had access. So that was one of the ways in which we were able to recognize that there are differences. The other thing is that in the continuing resolution on the work of the task force, other voices will be brought into that conversation. There'll be other teaching materials that will be produced. And in the use of the trial rites, which will be in effect for the next 3 years, we'll learn a lot about how they're used and how people respond to them. So there's a lot more work to be done and a lot more a conversation to be had before all this becomes totally final in terms of these liturgies becoming part of our Book of Common Prayer.
You may have addressed this, but will the ceremony or specific words used in the church be different for same-sex couples?
Right. So there are actually two liturgies for marriage that were made available, and these are liturgies for all couples, for any couple to use. One is based on the covenanted the liturgy for covenanted relationships that we've had in effect for the last 3 years, and that adapts that language for marriage. The second rite that's authorized for trial use is modeled on our Book of Common Prayer, and it changes some of the language and the wording in that rite to make it accessible for same-sex couples to use. But all couples can use either of the two rites that were approved for trial use.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, the leader of the worldwide communion that oversees the Episcopal Church, expressed deep concern after last week's vote, and he was worried about the stress the decision might cause on the larger Episcopal community.
Sure. We were very mindful of that, and of course, the bishops issued a Mind of the House resolution in which we affirmed our continuing support for our commitments around the Anglican Communion and mission and ministry. We also elected at this General Convention the first African-American presiding bishop, Michael Curry, Bishop of North Carolina, just a wonderful, wonderful man who will have as part of his portfolio the relationship with the wider Anglican Communion, with the Archbishop of Canterbury, and with the other presiding bishops and primates of the Anglican Communion. So I think we're okay. I mean, it is a tension, and we recognize that. But we also know that our common commitment to mission, to Christ's mission, is at the heart of what we do together. So that needs to remain strong.
Many who argued against the Supreme Court's ruling on same-sex marriage believe it will negatively impact religious freedom. In your opinion, is that at all a valid concern?
Well, it's It's hard for me to know. I don't think it does, because there's built into our system certainly a lot of capacity for clergy, as we mentioned earlier, to decline any marriage. I don't think it's an invasion of religious freedom, but I'm apparently others do, and so it's a difference of opinion, I think, on that, and we'll have to see how it plays out as we go forward. I was going to say I was listening to your program on end of life issues, and what struck me about this is that now the legal protection for gay and lesbian couples, for all the things that you were talking about, have dramatically increased, and it will be very interesting to see how that all plays out.
It will be. It's fascinating. You're right. They go hand in hand.
Yes.
Well, Thomas Ely, thank you very much. I appreciate you being on the program.
Well, thank you, Nina, and thanks for the time to talk about this.
Thomas Ely is Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Vermont. The precision of mathematics may seem at odds with the creativity of art, but when it comes to classical music, the two disciplines have been closely intertwined. VPR's music education series, Timeline, explores the roots of Western music. And today, VPR classical host James Stewart takes us into the long history and connections between music and math.
Mathematics and music?
Ah, you'll find mathematics in the darndest places.
A squared plus B squared equals C squared. That is, of course, the Pythagorean theorem from geometry, named for the Greek philosopher and religious teacher from 5th century BCE, Pythagoras. Pythagoras taught the belief that numbers were a guide to the interpretation of the universe. Mathematics could explain everything, including music. Legend states that one day, Pythagoras was walking past a smithy's workshop, listening to the sound of the blacksmith's hammers on the anvil. He turned his attention to the percussive sound that was produced and noticed that some strikes sounded much higher than others. He was certain that there was a mathematical explanation for the different pitches he was hearing. So he entered the smithy's shop and observed that they were using different sized hammers. Some of the hammers were large and others smaller, but they were ratios of each other. One being twice the size of another, one being two-thirds the size of the last. Pythagoras declared these relationships as absolute intervals of music. It's a great story, but completely false. That's not how these ratios actually work. But if we apply the story to lengths of string rather than hammers, we have something much more plausible. Pythagoras is attributed with discovering that a string exactly half the length of another will play a pitch that is exactly an octave higher when struck or plucked. Split a string into thirds, and you raise the pitch an octave and a fifth. Split it into fourths, and you go even higher. You get the idea. This concept is known as the overtone series, or harmonic series, and it's a feature of physics, affecting waves and frequencies in ways we can see and hear, and ways we can't. Pythagoras believed that the planets themselves, all heavenly bodies, rang out notes of vibration based on their orbit and distance to each other. We humans simply lack the ability to hear this music of the spheres. These mathematical ratios help to define every system of intonation throughout history. In other words, we tune our modern-day instruments using the mathematics that Pythagoras discovered almost 2,500 years ago.
That's James Stewart, our colleague at VPR Classical, and you can find out more about Pythagoras and his contribution to music at vpr.net/classical. And while you're there, you can listen to other stories in Timeline, VPR's music education series. And we're still getting emails on our end-of-life discussion. David in Burlington posted on Facebook, "Something I realized while my father was passing recently was that many people leave end-of-life instructions and funeral requests for music to be played, but when the doctors suggested we play him music while he was in a coma, we knew his favorite bands, but not songs he would really want played. So considering making a quote-unquote coma playlist. Doesn't have to be digital, but a list of songs to play is a great thing to add to your end-of-life instructions." Well, that'll do it for today's program. Tomorrow on the show, populism. Pundits have described Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign as fueled by populist sentiment, but that label has also been applied to Hillary Clinton and Republican candidates like Ted Cruz. So what does populist mean? We'll take a historical look at populism in politics tomorrow on Vermont Edition. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Galen Rosen. Mary Williams directed today's program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. From the PEG TV studios in Rutland, I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.